Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, we hear from Glacier Farm Media's John Gregg about what he heard at the recent Dairy Farmers of Canada annual policy conference.
Federal Agriculture Minister McCauley was there, and they were quite adamant that if the Americans wanted more access, he needed to tell them to go back to the TPP agreement.
Lisa Gunther of Grain News explains a new project aimed at fighting fusarium head blight.
I spoke to Corey Wilness, who's president of Crop Pro Consulting. Corey explained how they go about creating field maps in that area.
And Dave Sims of Commodity News Service Canada makes sense of the markets.
Canola has been showing some strength these days as it's managed to pop above the $500 mark.
All on Between the Rows with this week's host, Gord Gilmore.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. The Canadian dairy sector has been in the spotlight a lot lately as a result of some trade deals that are opening up their markets. We're joined now by John Gregg, who attended the recent Dairy Farmers of Canada annual policy conference in Ottawa earlier this month. John, tell me, what happens at a Dairy Farmers of Canada annual policy conference?
This is the chance that the dairy sector has to get together nationally. The boards of directors of most of the provincial boards come to this meeting. A lot of their staff are at that meeting, and they get together and they talk about the broader issues. They have speakers on the broader issues, and they also hear updates from the national organization on what's happening. And this at this meeting, some of the main topics were trade, of course, as you mentioned, is a dominant discussion in the dairy industry. There's quite a bit of discussion on marketing because Ontario has withdrawn its funding for the big expensive marketing campaigns that dairy farmers have. Communications, and then some concern over some of the Health Canada food guidelines and labeling.
So this is really their chance to sort of weigh in on all of the kind of national issues facing them.
That's right.
So what was the mood then at the meeting? And especially, I'm curious around trade with the signing of the TPP2, as I guess it's kind of colloquially known, and then the NAFTA renegotiations that are ongoing. What were folks saying in the hallways and so forth?
So there's significant concern, mostly with NAFTA. So the CPTPP, as I think the official name is, I think, is the dairy sector gave up 3.25% of the market, and they will tell you that that was fine. They knew that the rest of the agriculture sector and the rest of the economy needs these trade agreements, and they were willing to give that up. The trick is when the Americans pulled out of it, and then Canada continued to want to be part of it. They signed it with that 3.25% minus the Americans. So now the concern and kind of a bit of the unhappiness is that the Americans could then renegotiate NAFTA with more access, and it's probably likely to happen in some form. That they would the dairy sector would have to give up even more access than they thought. They already had a nice agreement they were willing to live with that had the Americans in it. So there was the agriculture minister, federal agriculture minister McCauley was there, and they were quite adamant to him that that if the Americans wanted more access, he needed to tell them to go back to the TPP agreement, that they had the access, they had it, they gave it up. So, if they want it, go back to TPP. So then the other question they had is when we signed the CETA agreement with Europe, free trade agreement with Europe, there was a significant value program to help dairy farmers transition because we gave up more market access during that period. There were questions from Minister McCauley, also discussions on whether there would be a similar program now that the dairy sector has given up more market access with the CPTPP. And McCauley did not have any answers for them on that at this point.
Well, I think that that's a good thing when they're able to sort of hold the minister accountable and get some answers from them, or at least put them on the hot seat and ask for them. Mm-hmm. What about some of the other issues that were contentious at this meeting? For example, funding marketing. You had indicated in one of the stories I saw that you filed out of this conference that it was quite a contentious issue, which to me surprised me a little. It seemed like a kind of a mum and apple pie sort of a thing. So why is that? What's made this seemingly innocuous thing so controversial?
Well, there's always been debate in dairy farmers spend a very large amount of money on marketing milk, as we know from the number of ads we see, some really iconic ads that we've seen from dairy, the dairy industry over the last 50 years. However, those programs are very expensive. They cost farmers, and farmers are the ones that, that pay for them, a lot of money. There was a farmer from British Columbia who milks 500 cows who was at the meeting, and he says that that his bill for marketing and promotion just from his farm alone is $100,000. So it's, as dairy farms have grown, that number is a significant expense for them. And Ontario, the chair of the Dairy Farms Ontario board told me that they've been asking for 6 years for information on return on investment. Is there a link between all this money they're spending on promotion and marketing and the sale of milk or the sale of other milk products? And we know, especially the other thing that's driving this, is that the sale of fluid milk, as it is in most of the Western world, it has been declining, and certainly is in Canada. So when Ontario couldn't get that answer, they pulled all their marketing funding. They're quick to say they're quite supportive of DFC for its other functions, but and they are continuing to work with DFC on some marketing projects. But that's a $37.5 million amount that Ontario has pulled out. So that's going to affect over the next while, you know, some of the ability of dairy farmers to do national campaigns. There may be more regional type campaigns, and certainly that's what consumers in Ontario will see. Now, the Dairy Farmers of Canada is trying to address some of these concerns by hiring some very high-level firms who measure campaigns and return on investment. And they had a gentleman there from Don Mayo from a company called IMI, and he says they need another year of campaigns yet until he's happy with the amount of information he has to do this return on investment, you know, for market growth, to link it to that. But he had some interesting research that showed that the marketing campaigns that Dairy Farmers of Canada does do do have significant impact. In fact, unaided memory of branded level campaigns in their survey, the significant survey of Canadians, showed that milk was number three of all brands. You know, that beats Tim Hortons, Canadian Tire, all the banks. So that's significant. And then in the beverage category, milk is number three after Pepsi or Coke and Pepsi, ahead of all the beer brands. So according to this gentleman, all that money, all that spending has certainly creates awareness of milk products. But the question that a lot of farmers still want to know is, how does it affect our milk sales or the sales of dairy products?
Those are some interesting questions, but it sounds like it'll take some time to get the answers. The other thing you spoke about briefly earlier in our conversation here was that dairy farmers have been concerned about Canada's food guide and food labeling changes. Tell me a bit about that.
So there are livestock sector in general, I think, has quite a bit of concerns over this, and other food sector areas as well, because there's going to be such significant change in Canada's food guide. Really looking at making recommendations and not having the traditional areas. They used to say you needed a certain amount of servings of this and that and this. And the thought is that that's not going to be the way it's going to be presented. Dairy Farmers of Canada and other organizations have concerns that Health Canada is not following the most recent science and understanding of the role of fats, especially saturated fats. The governments for years have said, cut back on your fat. But certainly there have been extraordinary amount of coverage and science in the last number of years that says that's been the wrong approach. That's actually increased our sugar consumption. Maybe we need to look at fats, at more consumption of fats. And that is certainly showing up in the market for dairy products, for example. The growth of high-fat products, higher fat than no fat or very low fat products, has been growing significantly, especially butter and actually whole milk, for example, interestingly, was one positive part of the fluid milk area. So then the government is also coming out with warning labels. So we could put a warning label on something that has a certain level of, say, saturated fats, which dairy products do, and the concern is that people will just see that warning and go, oh, I'm not going to consume that at all. While that food may contain saturated fats, the government has some concerns about, it may contain other things that are healthy for you. And the concern is that consumers will then just choose something that isn't as healthy just to avoid that warning label. So that's part of a significant ongoing debate in how consumers are going to see their food on the shelves.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a very interesting story to watch, that food guide. I think it's going to have a lot of implications. Well, that's great, John. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Gord.
That was John Gregg, who writes for Glacier Farm Media in Ontario. We'll be speaking a bit later to Commodity News Service Canada's Dave Sims on the latest from the grain markets. But next, we're speaking to Lisa Gunther of Grain News about a unique field topography project that's aimed at fighting Fusarium head blight. Lisa, welcome to the show. You spoke recently to an agrologist about this topic, and I've got to say, linking field topography and Fusarium head blight management, that sounds pretty interesting. Can you tell us about what this agrologist had to say?
Yeah, thanks, Gord. Yeah, I really thought it was interesting as well. So I spoke to Corey Wilness, who's president of Crop Pro Consulting. Most of Crop Pro's clients are farming in northeastern Saskatchewan. And so Corey explained how they go about creating field maps in that area.
We developed a process called soil, water, and topography maps. And so the data layers that we collect are electrical conductivity and RTK elevation. And those two layers are built together so that you have a single map that incorporates all your water flows. That will be based on topography, so it'll categorize field into knolls, mid-slopes, depressions type thing. Your salinity will all, you know, be the exact shape and the location of where it actually is in the field. So that's the basic fundamentals of the zone maps that we use for sampling and soil applied prescriptions.
That's interesting, but why is it important to map the topography of the field?
That's a really good question, Gord. Corey says that they find water is the number one driver of variability. For example, mobile nutrients such as nitrate move where the water moves. Organic matter also builds up in areas that accumulate water, while the hilltops tend to have thin topsoils. In wet years, the crop suffers more in areas that accumulate moisture as well. So that all contributes to variability in crop maturity and plant stand. And Crop Pro uses this information to create variable seeding and fertilizer rates.
So our goal has been to even out the field so that you don't have the hills maturing quicker than the depressions, and you have optimal plant stands by varying your seed rates, putting more seed in the areas that have lower plant stands. So you have a consistent plant stand that's kind of all at the same stage with minimal tillers, so that when you come to spray it, you're mostly spraying the heads at the right stage.
So how much of a difference does this make to farmers who are managing Fusarium head blight?
Corey says the differences are small, but very small differences in Fusarium levels can add up to different grades. So in years where Fusarium is a problem, he says his clients do see differences in grades.
I've been playing around with that and perfecting it for, well, since 2013 was our first year we did a lot of this. And so since then, I would say, we've had a lot of success with it. And every field is different. Every farm is different. You're always tweaking things.
Well, thanks, Lisa. That was great.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for having me, Gord.
That was Lisa Gunther of Grain News telling us about how field topography can help battle Fusarium head blight. Up next is Commodity News Service Canada's Dave Sims with the latest from the grain markets. It's been a bit up, down, and sideways in the markets lately, Dave. What's been happening in the canola market?
Well, canola has been showing some strength these days as it's managed to pop above the $500 mark. You know, for weeks we were stuck in that $485 to $500 range, and canola was just hanging around in there. But, you know, the dry weather in Argentina has really helped lift the entire oilseed market, and recent weakness in the Canadian dollar has also been a catalyst for canola. And, you know, the commodity showed some resilience, too, when the financial markets went on their roller coaster there. Like, I think it was the Monday, the Dow Jones and the TSX plummeted, and canola hung firm. Which may not be a surprise because, I mean, when Donald Trump announced those tax cuts a couple of weeks back, like, the markets really began to surge. But canola didn't go on the ride. So, you know, when they fell, canola didn't have much to give back in the first place. So, I mean, it did take some of the juice out of the market, though, as the equity funds were really getting hammered. So they hit the, you know, just kind of went on the sidelines. So that kind of explains some of the low volumes we saw last week in canola, as, you know, the funds were just kind of waiting for the dust to settle. And canola, you know, went through the USDA released its monthly supply and demand report, and that initially canola went down with soybeans, and that is the agency, like the soybean ending stocks were up, so the oil seeds kind of went down. But then, you know, the speculators and the bargain hunters stepped in, and the market, just in the space of a few hours, quickly recoup those losses. So, you know, canola's hanging pretty firm. And I mean, commercial buying actually has been fairly stagnant because China has really stepped back for the moment. They don't seem to be making large purchases in canola. And our crush margins seem to be on the rise. So, no, canola is definitely showing resilience, I think.
So I understand you touched on the weather in Latin America a little bit earlier, and in particular about the dryness in Argentina. Now, I understand the weather in South America has really been moving around oilseeds in general. What can you tell us about that?
Well, we got some rain, or not we, but Argentina got rain the past, I think, 4 or 5 days, like over the weekend, like they got rain, and that's what the farmers wanted to see because, you know, the dryness is just, really being a problem for soybean planting. But like, it wasn't enough. Like initially the market was dropping because, I mean, it looked like we were going to get a whole bunch of rain, but they didn't get nearly as much. So that is definitely seems now to have underpinned both soybeans and canola in North America. Because they really seem to have problems. Like, I think the last estimate, Argentina's, it was either, I think, corn or soybeans had really dropped in terms of the production forecasts. Yeah, it was corn. Like, the USDA, I think, lowered Argentina's corn crop production estimate to 39 million tons, and that was 3 million tons lower than the previous forecast. So that just shows what, you know, what the dryness is doing.
And speaking of Latin America and Argentina in particular, I understand there was also some excitement surrounding a trucker strike that really basically shut their ports down. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yes, they seem to love their trucker strike in South America. One every season, it seems. And this one didn't go on. It was a little bit more than a week, I think. And it had to do with, basically, you know, the truckers wanted some more minimum payments, minimum grain hauling rates, that's what it was. But, you know, while they're waiting, like it was about 100 cargo ships or something were all stuck in the harbor waiting to load corn and soy and I'm sure grain too. And nothing was getting through. So, I mean, the government, I don't know if they caved in, but they agreed at least to meet with them. So the strike sort of seems to be over for now, but I don't think the truckers, you know, said for sure they're not going to if something else happens. So I think February 23rd is when the two sides are going to meet. But, you know, I mean, at one point, I think that some of the truckers are throwing their corn and their grain onto the road. So, yeah, they definitely know how to halt things down there. But I mean, I think some of the congestion is easing, and it didn't actually seem to have too much of an impact on the market. So, you know, smooth sailing for now.
And let's turn the page a little bit then. How are things looking for corn and wheat?
Well, corn has been gaining in recent days. You know, it wasn't that long ago the front month contract seemed to be clinging to that $3.50 a bushel mark. Like, it just seemed drawn to that. But now we're well above 360 and almost at 370. And demand for livestock feed and ethanol has really helped to prop things up. And the USDA, the supply and demand estimates, like the agency lowered the U.S. stockpile forecast. Or the ending stocks down to, I think it was 2.3 or 2.4 billion bushels, which was down from the previous month. So, you know, U.S. corn is becoming more competitively priced, too, against South America. And for Canada, it's a different situation. I think the vast majority of our corn is trucked from Manitoba to Alberta for the feedlots. And Chicago wheat, it's climbing a bit with short covering. You know, just a month ago, Chicago wheat was around $4.15 a bushel, but now we're above $4.60. So the dry weather forecast for the U.S. plains are really what's driving that market. And no one's planting winter wheat these days, so that's also underpinning the market. There's still a lot of wheat available throughout the world, though. But no, Chicago wheat's holding its own right now.
Well, that's great, Dave. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Dave Sims of Commodity News Service Canada making sense of the markets for us. That's another edition of Between the Rows. I'm your host, Gord Gilmore, wishing you a safe week and hoping you'll join us again soon.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.